Now that the sun is coming out and our city is no longer encased in ice, I don't know about you, but I'm feeling pretty invigorated, and I have caught myself daydreaming about all kinds of outdoor activities I want to take up, and not just the things I've done and liked in the past. For some reason, running sounds fun. It must be something about the promise of spring, but how do you start? Do you just lace up your sneakers and go? I'm Gina Kaufman, and if you are feeling inspired to take up running this spring, we've got advice on how to take the first steps on KCUR's Central Standard. My guest is Colleen Shaw-Vakes. She's a trainer and running coach. Hi, Colleen.
Hi, Gina.
Oh my gosh, will I be as happy as you if I take up running? You have the biggest smile.
Absolutely. There are amazing endorphins. You've heard of the runner's high, and it's legit for most people.
Okay. You are making a great case just sitting before me right now. Is this a popular time of year for people to reach out to you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like you said, the weather is nice. People start thinking, oh my gosh, I want to be outside as much as possible. And there's just something with the sunshine, I guess all that vitamin D that all of a sudden we're getting that makes people want to move.
Yeah. And I could be a whole new me this spring.
You absolutely could. I would love to help you be a whole new you.
Do you coach total beginners? Is that a thing that people do? Like, I don't run at all. I'm going to call up a running coach?
Absolutely. Yeah. I have coached everybody from I've never run a step before to I want to run 100 miles. So, and all in between, you don't have to be fast. You don't have to be an elite. Anybody can benefit from a running coach, especially if you're not sure where to start.
Okay, and that is the thing I'm not sure about. Can you start? Here's what I would like to hear. Do you have a success story of someone who just got like super into running and kicked butt, but like they started at zero?
Oh my gosh, absolutely. One of my dear friends, she came out to watch me run my first marathon, and she looked around at all these people running and she goes, oh my gosh, I didn't realize that everybody could run a marathon, all different ages and sizes and everything. She was like, I think I want to run. And she had, her parents had always told her, we don't run. We're good Swedish stock. We don't run.
What?
You know, this is
what
not what we
mean?
Do. I don't know. But they're, you know, farmers. We don't run. You know, we carry heavy stuff and everything.
Okay.
So she started running from nothing. She ran a 50 miler, did amazing, really loved running.
Found 5-0.
5-0. 50 miles. Yes. It's called ultra running, and it's a whole different niche of running, and they're crazy. But she did amazing, and she found that she really loved it. But she had, you know, and that was starting from zero.
Okay. So how did she start from zero? What were some of her first steps?
So honestly, one of the best ways to start running, it's a free app called the Couch to 5K. And it literally takes you from walking a few minutes, run 30 seconds, walk a few minutes, run 30 seconds. And every day there's a different amount. It starts to slowly decrease the walking and increase the running. And you're just, it takes you about 6 weeks to do it. And if you ever have a week where you're struggling, you just repeat that week. It's not a big deal. You're totally on your own. And it's like the easiest, best way to start running.
Okay, so this is not about me, but I'm the only example. I mean, I know more about myself as an example than any other I can think of. I'm going to take you through like a little bit of my own deal with running. Like, I have run a lot, actually, like as a younger person in school and stuff. Like, yeah. I did a track team for a little while. I was never like terrible, but I was also never good. And I never got to where I loved running. And then I just stopped. And I've tried to take it up again, but I really like walking a lot. And I don't just mean I like walking as opposed to running. I actively enjoy long, invigorating walks. And every time I run, no matter how excited I am, it takes just a little while for me to wonder, why am I not walking? And then I just start walking again.
You know what? And that is really fair. Here's the deal. What I tell people a lot, if you really genuinely try running and you don't like running, stop. There's so many other things you can do. And in your situation, I might actually suggest you might really enjoy trail running.
Okay, tell me more.
Because it's running in the woods.
Yes.
So like all those mountain bike trails you got to Swope or Shawnee Mission, and there's roots and there's rocks and there's trees. That's trail running. You can run those trails. You can hike those trails. And the nice thing about trail running is there's sections of trail where it might be so technical. There's so many rocks or branches and stuff you're stopping and stepping over that you're really doing a combination of running and walking, and you're forced to do it because that's what the trail gives you. And so it's a great way to kind of slow down and look around and be a little bit more involved in nature than, say, running on the roads and having to stop at stoplights and
totally.
Deal with cars and being catcalled or, you know, whatever that might be. So it's amazing. For somebody like you, I'd say pick up trail running.
Okay.
Check this out.
This is sounding perfect. The other thing, though, I think about that is with walking, I'm pretty good at walking, and so I don't have to think about it a lot, so I can think about other things, and I feel like I need to get over that hump with running.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, when I'm locked into my, you know, my great stride, and I'm feeling good, and the sun's shining, it's zen running. I can let my mind just go, and just really kind of tap into, you know, just the breath, and the feet fall, and, you know, the birds around me, and everything. But it does take a while to get there. And you know, you're looking at probably about 6 weeks of, you know, kind of struggling and some running and some walking and, you know, and just trying to find that happy place for you. And the biggest thing that I tell beginner runners is slow down. Because most people, when they say, oh, I've tried to run and I just can't. Well, that's not true. Everybody can run. I promise you, if a bear was chasing you, you could run. You would run very, very fast also. But most people, when they start running, they're like, I'm going to run. They lace up their shoes. They go out their front door and they take off down the street.
It sounds great.
Right. And then they die halfway down the block. And then they walk back and they're like, this sucks. I'm not doing this again. So whereas if you start with that run-walk combination, and walking during a run is not failure. It is not failure. I don't know where we've gotten this idea that you're not allowed to walk while running. You're totally allowed to walk while running. If that's where you're at, walk while running. I often do, and I've run for years and years and years, and I'm like, I'm going to walk. This is a pretty section. I'm going to look around. I'm tired. I'm going to walk for a bit. And then you start running again. So you can totally still incorporate your running and walking. It's just it's a way to get to a little bit further on down the path, maybe a little bit faster.
Okay. So what is some other, I mean, I like this practical advice of slowing down, incorporating some walking. What is some other practical advice?
Well, get yourself a good pair of shoes. That is like the one thing. You don't have to spend a lot of money on Garmin watches, although they're great, you know, fancy clothes, although they're great and they might make you feel good. A good pair of shoes is like the key to being comfortable when you start running. And it's not even that you have to spend a ton of money on the shoes either. Go to a good running store, have them get you on a treadmill, look at how you run, and get you into a pair of shoes that's correct for your foot.
So no internet shopping for your running shoes.
You know what? No. I mean, because you want a pair that's good for your foot. And most actual legit running stores, and not like Dick's Sporting Goods, not that they're not great for many other things, but a running store where all they do is running stuff or triathlons, you know, it's fine too. But an actual legit running store where this is what they do and this is all they sell are running shoes that are correct for running. And they're going to look at your foot and they're going to look at how you run on a treadmill and see if your knees are caving in and see if your ankles are caving in and put you in the right shoe and the correct fitting shoe. I can't tell you how many times I have a beginner runner that's like, oh, my feet hurt so bad when I run. I'm like, oh, because your feet are squeezed into your shoes. You need most running shoes. You're going to be a half a size to a full size bigger than your street shoe. And people don't realize that. And women especially don't realize that. And they don't like that per se. But it will help a ton. When we run, it's about 3 times your body weight is the force hitting the ground with every foot strike. So if you start with a good pair of shoes that are cushioned and everything, it's going to make it feel so much better. It really will.
Okay, so shoes that fit.
Yes.
Which seems obvious, but actually, as I'm listening to you, that I would not be naturally inclined to seek out shoes the way you just described. So
right.
Shoes that fit from people who know about shoes that fit. And we're going to incorporate some walking and take it kind of slow. We might do this on trails if we would like to not be catcalled and so forth.
Right.
And that brings up this other practical thing. Like, there are a lot of people who don't have access to good sidewalks just right out their front door.
Absolutely. And that is a thing. And actually, I was just having a conversation with somebody about being in very South Johnson County where she's like, I came to a spot, an intersection busy four-way street intersection and the sidewalk just ended and there was no sidewalk anywhere else. She's like, I had to run in the road. So you always want to run facing traffic. When you're running facing traffic, whether you're on a sidewalk or you're actually having to run in the road itself as far over to the side as possible, if you're facing the cars coming at you, you can launch yourself into a ditch if they're not moving over for you. Ideally, people are going to move over for you, which is also why you want to think about wearing bright colors if you're running on the roads. Bright orange, bright yellow, flashy bits that clip on you are great to be seen. Even in the daytime, flashing items really help cars see you because they're used to looking out for bright flashing lights. So it does actually help.
So we need to make ourselves look like cars?
Well, maybe. Beep, beep. Carry an air horn. Yeah.
Okay. So then that is a lot of good practical advice. What about psychological advice? Because I mean, our own minds can get in our way, even just from, you know, you were talking about this woman whose family had been like, we are people who don't run. I think I have developed a little bit of that idea about myself, and I'm sure that I'm not alone, like 100% positive.
Absolutely. And definitely the mental piece is a huge part of, you know, if you're getting into racing or running longer and stuff, is just reminding yourself every time that mind goes to, this is so hard. This is, I can't do this. My feet hurt. My knees hurt. This hurts. That hurts. Trying to really identify what you're doing and then turn it around. Okay, my feet hurt, but you know what? I'm out here running. It's a beautiful day. The sun is shining. There are people sitting in chairs in dark cubicles right now that wish they could be out here. And I always try and just turn my mind around and remind myself how lucky I am that I can move, that I'm, you know, privileged enough to be able to move, that I'm, you know, privileged enough to be outside at this time enjoying the sunshine, or even at night. I like running at night too, that, you know, trying to always just identify and turn that mindset around. It's a positive thing that I'm able to do this.
What's your favorite place to go running in Kansas City, which will now become very crowded as soon as you say it?
It would have to be a toss-up between the trails at Shawnee Mission Park and the trails at Swope Park. So just Kansas side, Missouri side, one of each.
Colleen Shaw-Vakes, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Colleen is a personal trainer and running coach with advice for people feeling inspired to take up running this spring. Up next, we will listen back to a conversation about historic floods in Kansas City, and we'll get updates on current flood protection as devastation along the Missouri continues. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now flooding. A few years back, we invited one of our favorite local historians, Monroe Dodd, to talk about how flooding has literally shaped our city in ways we don't tend to think about when everything's fine. But with recent flooding along the Missouri River, we wanted to revisit that conversation and also get some new information about what's going on with the levees along our banks right now. That update is on the way, but for now, let's listen back to get the history.
All spring it rained. Over the plains of Kansas and the fields of Missouri, it rained, rained, rained. It rained during 23 of the 30 days of June, with more in July. Telephone workmen called it a frog strangler. Finally, a mid-July deluge in central Kansas pulled the trigger. The soggy soil could take no more. Rivers burst their weakened dikes, and one of the worst floods in the nation's history was underway. On came the swirling floodwaters, down the Kaw, down the Cottonwood, down the Neosho, down the Smoky Hill.
And eventually into Kansas City. This documentary, made by AT&T, tells the story of the flood of 1951, one of the biggest floods that destroyed and shaped parts of Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on Central Standard, we're talking about how floods have guided Kansas Cityans in their decisions about where to build a business or a neighborhood and where not to do those things. A lot of what the city looks like has to do with flooding. I'm pleased to welcome historian and journalist Monroe Dodd to the studio. Hi, Monroe.
Hi, Gina.
Let's get a sense of the scale of influence flooding has really had. How would you characterize the relationship between Kansas City as we know it today and major floods of the past?
Actually, it goes back to the relationship between Kansas City and the rivers. You know, Kansas City owes its place on the map to rivers, the conjunction of the Kansas River and with the Missouri River. Because rivers allowed people in the earliest days of European settlement, in fact, for Native Americans too, easy transportation up and down. When railroads came along, they found the grades very comfortable to build alongside rivers. Rivers helped Kansas City prosper, but Kansas City, as you just pointed out, has suffered quite a bit too, because there's a downside to rivers and streams, and that's they occasionally go over their banks. The history of flooding in Kansas City was in some of the earliest floods getting away from it, moving up from it. And in some of the later floods, it was, how do we stop this? How do we put up a wall? How can we keep this flooding out? That's what's gone on for, since merely 1826.
Can you name a distinctive feature of the Kansas City landscape that is where it is and looks how it looks because of flooding or people's fear of flooding?
Union Station is a perfect example. In the late 19th century and until about 1903, the railroads, as I said, came up on the gentle grades along rivers. And so for passenger services, Union Depot, which was built by 7 or 8 railroads, was perfectly situated down in the West Bottoms. But after the flood of 1903, they realized there were numerous reasons for this. But one of the big reasons they realized that Union Station is where it is that, gosh, this place is flooded. We had stuff within a yard of the globes hanging down, the lights from the ceiling, covering up passenger signs. It was useless for weeks. Let's build it on higher ground. So Union Station we know today is on high ground, relatively.
Wow. And when was that built again?
Union Station opened in 1914.
Huh. Well, let's back up. As settlers were arriving in this area, was the threat of floods something that they thought about? I mean, you've talked about that eventually people started moving away from the river, but you don't have to have already lived by a river to know that a possibility of a flood exists there.
That's right. But I think most of those early settlers probably believed, well, let's see, our odds are good. They're not perfect, but they're good. And gosh, we can certainly move these packs of fur downstream, where they were trading with the Native American tribes for furs. We can move them downstream to St. Louis so easily if we're situated right down here near the river. And Francois Chouteau and his community of French-speaking fur traders did so over near Randolph. And then 1826, along came a flood. Their operation is kiboshed right there.
Tell me about that flood of 1826.
It rose. It was little recorded because there were only a few score European Americans here who had anything to record. But Francois Chouteau and his group definitely felt it and said, we got to get out of this area near Randolph. Let's move upstream and to higher ground. And so they did, closer to the mouth of the Kaw River, where they stayed until the flood of 1844. By then, the commercial development of the town of Kansas, plotted out by a group of real estate developers and early settlers, was sitting down near the river, and the river came up. And one of its believed to be the highest in Kansas City history, although records of the time were not as well kept, ran up warehouses, made lots of people move farther up and farther away from the river. More levees were needed and so forth with the tools they had to build them. That flood in 1844 persuaded a lot of shippers that Independence was no longer a good place to land their steamboats because Independence Landing had become a mud flats. Kansas City had a rocky shelf that protruded out, and when the waters went down, there was a rocky shelf again. What a great pier, what a great key into the river. And steamboats migrated more and more there. And so more and more shipping means more and more for the warehouseman, more commerce, and it just got the critical mass going for Kansas City.
So that location of downtown Kansas City, really some other places had been kind of tried out.
In a sense, that had been experimented with, and the location turned out to be a fortunate one. It was close enough, on higher enough ground, that rocky shelf where a steamboat could land, that hotels could go there, warehouses could go there, people could live and work and make money there. The various trails that left here, the Oregon Trail, Santa Fe Trail, and other stuff, which were either the Oregon Trail took families and the Santa Fe Trail took merchandise. It was a great place to land right there. So that acreage that the guys who had invented the town of Kansas purchased was perfect. Like a lot of real estate, it was, they were very lucky.
Well, so we've heard about some really early floods and how they shaped even just where Kansas City is, not even like specific features of Kansas City. But the flood of 51 is really a huge one. And it's also probably the oldest flood that people today can remember. What happened and how did people respond to it in terms of urban design? Let's stick with the what happened first.
You heard the dramatic description of the rains out west, the Smoky Hill and the Saline and the high water moved down the Kansas or Kaw River. Junction City, I believe, was flooded. Manhattan was flooded.
And when you say flooded, I mean, some of the descriptions I've read from people who remember it, this is dramatic. This is, you know, I don't know, just huge disaster caliber stuff.
Especially if they had a business or a house in the lowlands. As you know, floods don't just knock on the door and crash down the door necessarily. The water rises. And that was what also happened in Topeka and then Lawrence. And then down the river it came. Finally, despite the efforts of a lot of emergency workers to sandbag the Kaw River over in the Argentine area to the west, the water seeped through. It came through there. And then on July, I believe, 13th, it came through in the stockyards themselves. Armourdale was underwater, and there were a lot of people who lived in Armourdale.
Submerged, right?
Right, and a lot of people who lived in the packing plants. A lot of houses were washed away. Some were never found. Argentine, where a lot of people worked in the Santa Fe Railroad yards. And then, of course, the West Bottoms, where a lot of the economic engine that had driven Kansas City for decades and decades was. Well, it was decommissioned. The stockyards underwater.
Are there still like watermarks on structures today? Like, can you see the signs of this water that rose so high?
There's a fabulous one on a church in the Argentine area, a stone church whose name I can't remember right now, but you can go to it. And there's a mark. We haven't mentioned the 1903 flood. That was a big thing. But there's a mark, a brass plaque that says, here's where the 1903 flood was. Way up above that, almost beyond vision, is a mark saying, here's where the 51 flood came. It was big.
The 51 flood, one of the descriptions that I've heard involves, you know, cemeteries flooding. And is that something that really happened, or is that just someone's recollection getting imaginative?
Most memorably, it happened in the 1993 flood. There was a cemetery near Hardin, Missouri, where the caskets actually came up and began floating away.
Wow.
Any cemetery in the lowlands, anything in the lowlands, is going to be affected by the flood. And the lowlands, of course, is the path of the river as it goes back and forth over the centuries and the millennia, carving this area. It leaves itself a nice flat area of nice soil, good for farming, but bad for flooding.
How long was this going on? I mean, how long was Kansas City just living in this state of being submerged and not knowing when it was going to stop or how?
Typically, these floods last about a week before they finally, the water evacuates downstream. In 1993, flooding happened in July, and it happened again in August. There was bouts of floods, all depending on the rainfall and where it fell.
Back to this flood of 51, though, how did people respond to it in terms of urban design?
For one thing, that was about when the advent of air conditioning had come along. But if you couldn't get cool water, especially in the early air conditioning types in movie theaters and stuff, it was difficult to run the air conditioning. The water plant, one of Kansas City's water plants, was inundated. Fortunately, another one survived it. But urban design, the biggest part of urban design I can think of is the meatpacking plants, which were a major smoky element and a job producer down in the West Bottoms that gave them a large part of the impetus they needed to just leave town.
To go to the smaller towns in rural areas, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Man, I've heard that the airport moved north of the city as the result of that flood. And I had always wondered why we put our airport so far away from our downtown. It seems that flooding is why. I mean, the airport had once been much closer to these areas you're describing.
We're talking about the airport that was in the Fairfax District, which is now part of Kansas City, Kansas. It hadn't been incorporated then. That's where TWA had its overhaul base, and there was a landing strip and a little terminal and a tower and things. And that was flooded by virtue of a levee breaking and a sewer line breaking in 1951, after the West Bottoms had gone underwater. TWA, there are scenes and photographs of the inside of the TWA overhaul base, and it's just a muddy mess. You can see why they'd say, we're leaving here, we're going to someplace where there's higher ground, and the higher ground they found was near Platte City.
So yeah, that's why the airport is where it is. That's wild. And then there's the flood of 77. That's another big one that comes after 51. I was an infant during that flood, and my family lost a lot of photographs because, as the legend goes anyway, the basement filled completely with water, and apparently I, as an infant, was put upstairs and just hope for the best. But, you know, what do you remember about the flood of 77?
That a lot of basements were flooded. Not only homes in the basin of Brush Creek and Rock Creek and the Blue River, but also businesses in the Country Club Plaza. It's remembered as the Plaza Flood because this was this big commercial district, Kansas City's main high-end retail district at that time in 1977. And windows were broken out, cars were washed away, diners at the Alameda Plaza restaurant were looked down and couldn't believe what they saw.
Was there any warning of this flood? I mean, did people see it coming?
It was an unexpected dump of rain upstream. There had been days of flooding around Kansas City, and surely the ground was packed with moisture. But there's unexpected, kind of almost like a micro storm that occurred upstream that just drove this thing. And I want to mention also that most of the deaths, the 20-some-odd deaths attributed to the flood, and a lot of the economic damage happened downstream in the less well-known areas along the Blue River. And so the Corps of Engineers and the city, and Corinne, I'm sure, can talk about all this, did a lot of changes to Brush Creek and the Blue River to make those, to try at least to make those flow smoothly.
But why was it that that area flooded primarily?
Because the rain fell there. Just as in 51, the rain fell upstream on the Kaw and its tributaries. And in 1903, the rain fell upriver on the Missouri.
So what changed after the flood of 77? I mean, did that, you just alluded to some change. Any others that you want to point out that are significant?
The change in Brush Creek is quite significant. What used to be a concrete drainage ditch essentially became this place with wrought iron fences and railings, and people can run and walk along it and other stuff. That was a major change that you could drive across the bridge on Troost here and see the change. Volcker Fountain was moved.
Do you think that people, I mean, did people stop building new shopping areas in this area because of the flood? I mean, could Zona Rosa be where it is for the same reason that the airport is where it is?
Oh, it could be, but the Country Club Plaza fought back right away. Some of the shops were reopened within weeks. Again, it was this notion of the Kansas City spirit, which had arisen after the convention hall fire at the turn of the century and then was illustrated by Norman Rockwell at the behest of Joyce Hall after the 1951 flood, the guy rolling up his sleeves with a bunch of plans, getting ready to go rebuild. The idea of the Kansas City spirit.
Well, Rockwell painted that in response to the 51 flood.
That's right.
Yeah.
Commissioned by Joyce Hall.
Wow.
And in a sense, that same kind of spirit, if that kind of thing really exists, happened right after the Plaza flood, when all along the Brush Creek and the Blue River commercial rebuilding took place.
And of course, we've alluded to the flood of 93. Lots of generations of listeners can recall that one. Tell me about that flood. What caused it and how did it play out?
The major word for Kansas City after that, during that flood, was, phew, we made it. The water came up within a foot or so of the top of the flood wall. But upriver along the Missouri, downriver along the Missouri, I mentioned the Hardin Cemetery, farms were inundated with sand and things, removing them from agriculture. There were lots of rural problems with that flood. Also, St. Louis was flooded. A lot of that happened. Kansas City escaped the worst of it because the dikes, the levees held.
But there were some really tragic events in the West Bottoms, if I remember correctly.
In the flood of 93, this I don't remember off the top of my head.
Oh, okay. Just it seems like the few maybe artists who were down there, and it wasn't highly populated at the time, but I seem to remember that there were a couple of tragedies in the West Bottoms.
Well, because no one knew how high the water would go, there were evacuations of businesses in the West Bottoms and homes in Armourdale also.
Well, so can you understand the story of Kansas City without taking floods into account? I mean, is this a crucial part of who we are and how we behave as people who travel around and use the geography the way we do?
I think it's a part. Anytime a flood sticks in memory, in your memory, the 77 and the 93 floods, and there was one in 98, too, that killed a lot of people on the Prospect Bridge over Brush Creek, these things stay in our memory. And we also remember if we're down near a stream when we're buying a house, we might want to think twice before doing that.
There's something that it seems like we haven't quite touched on enough, which is the environmental impact of the 1903 flood.
Because the West Bottoms was the nerve center of Kansas City in 1903, and because Kansas City by then had, the metro area had grown to surpass 200,000 people, that was a big flood that a lot of people noticed. It happened largely in the West Bottoms. I believe it was as much a Missouri River as a Kaw River flood, but it affected the electric power plant, which cut off electricity for a week to the city, and it also meant that streetcars couldn't run. They were mostly electrified by 1903. Streetcars were really important because few people owned automobiles. It affected the gas works. Out goes natural gas, which is sometimes used for lighting then, and certainly for heating and cooking. It affected the waterworks, and so goes fresh water. Hard to find then. You got to boil everything. All those things that had been in the West Bottoms and had been vulnerable to flooding were out, and suddenly people said, we need to do a bunch of different things. One, the railroads decided they would, as I mentioned, move Union Depot. There needed to be backups to the waterworks, a different place to generate electric power and so forth. And we need better flood walls. Kansas invented a thing called the Kaw Valley Drainage District, which is a very humdrum-sounding name. But the point of it was to build levees and walls along the Kansas River in hopes of preventing a flood like that in the future. Didn't survive 50 years, but that was the hope.
Monroe, do you see possibilities for Kansas City's future that wouldn't have been considered options in the past because of flooding?
Possibilities for Kansas City's future, maybe so. High ground is always a possibility. After the flood of 1903, a guy named William Strang came to visit his mother, who lived here, and all the news was about the big flood. And he decided to put his real estate developments that he wanted to start out on high ground in Johnson County, a real estate development named Overland Park. And if you shop or you live in Overland Park today, it's, as you know, it's the driver of Johnson County. And it is the direct result of that flood. So there's a policy, an economic developer's policy.
That was Monroe Dodd on a show we did 4 years ago all about how floods shaped Kansas City. When the conversation first aired, we turned next to an engineer to hear about the protections that have been put in place since those historic floods. But with all the flooding in our region going on today, we decided to invite her back for an update. That is coming up on KCUR's Central Standard. Don't go away. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and our next guest is Corinne Jacoby. She's an engineer who's worked in waterway management, and she is also an attorney who now works in levee and flood protection practice at Hush Blackwell. Hi, Karen. Corinne, excuse me.
Good morning, Gina.
So we just heard about how floods in Kansas City really devastated parts of this city at various points in our past. It is so striking to hear about all of this right now, as so much serious flooding is happening throughout our region along the Missouri River, with Kansas City proper so far doing mostly okay, though there are some very nearby locations that are seeing consequences already.
Yes, that's true. And certainly I want to say first that my heart goes out to the families and the communities that are suffering and striving to recover from the flooding. Kansas City is very fortunate. We're an urban area. Our level of protection, as in most areas, urban areas, is higher than in the surrounding rural areas.
Why is that? Just the population density or the political leverage?
I would say it's somewhat of a policy, more documented on the Mississippi River, where the Corps of Engineers focused on in a report that they did several decades ago on providing a 50-year level of protection for rural areas as compared to 100-year or better for urban areas, in part because of the benefit cost, but also just to manage the floodwaters that are there. What we see now is Kansas City, and we heard in our earlier segment about the 93 flood. Following that, we saw that there were some inconsistencies in the level of protection of the Kansas City levee system, and work was begun in 1995 to investigate why we had those inconsistencies.
Can you describe what you mean by inconsistencies?
Well, some of the systems were, they performed differently. Some of them were closer to overtopping than others. And it had thought that there was going to be kind of across the board was going to work more as a system, even though there were several separate levy units, the Kaw Valley systems, the Fairfax systems we heard about in the earlier segment.
So they didn't all perform the same way.
Correct. But now much of the work has been done to improve reliability and to work toward that common level of protection. And with recent federal funding here in 2018, that work that was begun in 1995 following the 93 floods is now fully funded and can move forward to completion.
But it has not already moved forward to completion.
Not all of it. But, you know, a lot of the kind of using the worst first approach, I would say, areas where there was a likelihood that a flood wall could fail, a greater likelihood that it could tip over with pressures from the water, or there was a lot of water moving underneath the flood walls that needed to be removed and managed. That work took place first. There's still an appreciable amount of work to be done in the Argentine and Armourdale areas, and that's mostly the work that was recently funded.
So do you think that Kansas City being so far relatively spared is because of this work that has happened recently, or is that too much of a cause and effect, like oversimplification?
I would say that, you know, it improves the reliability of our system, but our level of protection, that higher level of protection from a 500-year event, which is the event that, you know, has a 0.2% chance of occurring in any given year, not once every 500 years. Just have to put that out there.
So it's called a 500-year event, but it is, that means event with a 0.2% chance of happening. Is that what you just said?
That's correct.
Okay.
A 100-year, 1% chance of happening in any given year. Somebody thought it would make it simpler to do it that way. I think that
somebody
was...
Somebody thought wrong, but go on.
Yes, yes. Well-intentioned, but... In any case, that higher level of protection in the urban area, in the Kansas City area, is what, you know, and what you have similarly in St. Louis and other areas is really what allows us to weather these storms the way we do.
When did you, so you first got involved in the management of Kansas City's waterways right around the time of that 93 flood, right?
Yes, in 95, I was in St. Louis working flood recovery in 93. And then after that, I came to Kansas City in 95 and began managing the Brush Creek project in 96. And
what inspired you to take such an active interest in flooding and flood prevention?
I think it was a convergence of several things. As I said, I grew up in St. Louis. I suffered flooding in my own homes on three separate occasions, once from Missouri River flooding that lasted for a long time, but also a couple of times from urban runoff. Urban runoff is more like what we would see in and around here, where there's just a lot of rainfall. There's no place for it to go and get away from. And so homes.
This is what people talked about in Houston a couple of years back, right, with all the pavement.
That's part of it. Uh-huh. Yeah. And the pavement, but then also what is the size of your storm sewer systems to evacuate that water, right? And those storm sewer systems, they vary, you know. And the idea is that a lot of that runoff will go along the streets when you have those high events. And but sometimes even that isn't adequate. So I had that going on, and I had done some work, I said, you know, on the recovery in the 93 flood. And it just really became almost a mission after a while. You know, it's like we flood protection is so important to lives and livelihoods. And a friend of mine in Louisiana, Wendell Curl, he's from Lafourche, Louisiana, levee district down there. And I think he says it best with a quote that without flood protection, nothing else matters. You know, and I do feel that way. I mean, it's that important to people, to their communities, to the economic viability, to resilience. I mean, that this has to be done.
You started out pursuing flood protection as an engineer and moved into an area where you are using that engineering expertise, but in the legal arena. What is so we've heard a little bit about just like the structural challenges and the importance of, you know, making sure that levees and flood walls aren't too vulnerable, et cetera. But like, what is the legal obstacle?
Well, when I was with the city and working on projects like Brush Creek, Blue River, Turkey Creek, Kansas City levees, I found myself often sitting in a room with attorneys and being the only engineer and trying to figure out, well, what do we need to do to make this work from a financing perspective, from a property perspective, from a regulatory perspective? And in order to get those projects well on their way, it occurred to me that better understanding the law and how that feeds into the decision-making process was important. So I went to school here at UMKC at night, got my law degree, got my projects largely on their way, and now I help other folks in the Midwest and South get their projects.
But how does the law play into this?
Regulatory is a big part of that. There's a lot of regulations and an increasing number of regulations and changes in those regulations, as there is a trend to kind of look more broadly at flood protection from a risk management perspective. But, you know, how and who gets to make the decisions on what is the level of flood protection that a community can have?
So is this kind of getting back a little bit to that question of the protections that a densely populated urban area gets as compared to rural areas that are really suffering right now?
That's true. That is part of it. And that, you know, and the law's not entirely clear on these things, on floodplain management, whether you're in the National Flood Insurance Program, if your community has adopted the voluntary floodplain management requirements, which then you as a community have to enforce.
What are those?
So if you're, the National Flood Insurance Program is kind of set up as a program to incentivize better floodplain management. So to do that, the way FEMA undertook that, and the federal government undertook it at the time, was to say, okay, we're going to have floodplain management regulations that say in the special flood hazard area, or that area that's subject to inundation during this 100-year or 1% chance event, you can only build and do certain things in that area and in a certain way. And if your community is going to have access to flood insurance that's federally backed through the National Flood Insurance Program, you have to agree to adopt and enforce these floodplain management regulations so that the flooding risk is mitigated in your community, but also the national flood risk does not continue to grow. So that was the concept behind that program.
How do you think that's working?
Well, there are some that say that it's not working very well, because we do see, you know, a growing pure dollar cost for flood disaster. But then there's also folks that look at that and say, but when you look at the cost of flood disaster as compared to a percentage of gross domestic product, it's considerably decreased. So it's really kind of how do you find the apples to apples conversation in that. Has it made a difference? Undoubtedly, it's made a difference.
There's also, I mean, people talk a lot about that these disasters happening more often and more strikingly, perhaps, that could be part of a change in our climate, that it could be.
Right. And engineers, I think, rather than talk about it in terms of climate change, would kind of look at it more in terms of stationarity. So a lot of the predictions for water resources management, which includes droughts and floods, were based on a statistical record over a period of time. And the highs and lows, the droughts and the floods, the rainfall amounts and the dry periods, were relatively constant. There wasn't a big sway up and down during that time of stationarity. But now we're seeing the highs and the lows get farther apart. So what that means is those predictions and that data that we had when we designed a lot of the projects that are in place now, that are used to manage our water resources now. Those were based on a set of data that's not reflective of current conditions. So I think the bigger question is, well, what do we do about that?
Yeah, what do we do about that?
And I think what we have to really wrestle with is consider new ideas, removing those parameters that constrain our current thinking and how those systems are managed, because managing that system better is only going to get us part of the way there. We can improve the efficiency of the system, but it's not the sole answer. We have to get beyond that, and we have to do the hard work of thinking about the what if and not the why not, to come up with ideas that could be useful to meeting the needs of future generations.
But can you talk a little bit more specifically about what you mean there?
So we think about, you know, the operations, river operations. You think about endangered species, current listed endangered species, for example. And if those species are recovered to where they're no longer endangered, does that open a space to look at things differently or manage things differently?
So is the idea here that environmental regulations are have put a, put some constraints on flood management that, that you want to?
I think that's, you know, one aspect of flood management and water resources management are regulations, floodplain management regulations.
Can you explain that, though? What's the relationship there?
Well, because the Missouri River, for example, it's authorized by Congress for eight purposes, water supply, flood protection, navigation, recreation, and
a
more.
Few more.
Right. I always forget one. But in any case, the primary purposes for which it's authorized, which the courts have held, are flood control and navigation. But the flood control and navigation purposes have to be met while complying with the environmental requirements.
Which I think for, on the face of it, it sounds like, yeah, you want the management of your water to be environmentally friendly.
Sure. So, but I think what the distinction there is it's not a balancing of those eight purposes, right? Everything's not the same. These things are primary. You have to meet these. And then here's these other purposes that are supplemental to that. So understanding that legal framework informs kind of, okay, where you can make the decisions. And
I mean, we spoke, last time we spoke was 4 years ago. What are some of the biggest changes for any one of those categories in the last few years?
Oh, let's see. What have we seen? So we've seen we've seen some things come and go. There was an executive order for the federal flood risk management standard that had been issued that was then rescinded. And it had some real challenges with implementation and kind of how it works. The idea of having that kind of a standard hasn't gone away, and whether it will reemerge in some other form in legislation, which would be where you would more typically see those kind of requirements would be kind of coming through the Congress, are being considered. We've seen changes to, well, we haven't seen the changes yet, but just last week, FEMA announced Risk 2.0. And Risk 2.0 changes the way you identify risk and develop insurance rates for flood insurance. Those new rates are supposed to be out in April 1st of 2020 and go into effect October 1st of 2020. This is going to be a big change. And people are like, well, we don't know what the rates are yet.
So right? We don't know how it's going to change, but we know that it is going to.
Right. And we know there's people working on it. And those conversations are taking place. The flood insurance program is being reauthorized, private flood insurance, community-based flood insurance. So a lot of ways and tools to mitigate risk are being developed and put out for use.
When you, before, just quickly before we go, do you have some words to the communities other than, you know, you expressed your regrets that people are suffering right now as a result of flooding? As someone who has helped people get through those things many, many times, any words of advice, parting words of advice?
Well, keep your chin up. I would say that's important metaphorically and literally. Be aware that things are changing, not just on the ground and in the field, but the requirements and regulations as well.
Corinne Jacoby, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Gina. Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me back.
Corinne is a registered engineer with a background in public administration around our waterways, and she works as an attorney at Hush Blackwell in flood protection. Tomorrow, public transit is a hot-button issue. People are crazy about it, but ridership is actually down. That conversation tomorrow. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.